Back to poetry today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Poetry Month is long past, but we don't care. We're going to read some anyway on Scribble. How's that for a threat?
That's good.
We're going to read poetry today.
Yeah, well, we decided that we probably should pick poetry that is suitable for these isolated and solitary times that we're all caught in.
Well,
and it turns out all poems are suitable, so we've both got a sheaf of poems.
Yeah,
but I want to start out with what might be a metaphor. One of the little news items that wasn't about the virus this week, and I think most people probably missed it, is that the seismographs all over the world, those instruments put in everywhere, thousands of them around the world, to detect earthquakes and volcanoes and the shooting off of atomic bombs and things like that, have suddenly stopped picking up the vibrations of human activity. It's cut by two-thirds.
Isn't that interesting?
That is, I mean, we make a lot of noise as humans around the world, constantly, on the move, trucks, everything, airplanes, jackhammers. And as a result of this quietness, the seismographers are now able to pick up the faint sounds from the core of the earth that they'd never heard before.
Really?
Because human interference got in the way.
And we can breathe the air, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And I thought that really, you know, we are all in some sense trapped in our solitude. But on the other hand, there's some good from it, too. And I think for me that good is we are forced to pay attention to some of the small things that are really the good things.
That's
right?
True.
We're so busy getting kids off to soccer practice and going to this play and going to that play and doing this and doing that, that we spend little time in our backyard. You know, Thoreau said, talking about the friends of his that went around the world traveling and visiting all the different sites, he says, "I've traveled a great deal and conquered." And I think one of the things, even though it is very difficult to live in this kind of isolation, one of the things that we have as a gift is the time to spend and the quietness to listen to small things. So I've selected poems that pretty much have to do with small things.
Well, I've selected poems that are crazy, so, you know.
Well, good. Same thing.
But let me start with one by John Dumbeck that we may have read a long time ago that kind of fits into that. "Just as my eyes are closing for the final time, perhaps while watching the sublime wonder of the Milky Way's endless displays of galaxies and stars, I will know this fading glance is my final dance with everything I know. I've been told not to regret that I go. Rejoice. I will become one in the incomprehensible mystery, saturated in joy, awaiting me. Perhaps so. Still, I will miss the stars."
That is good.
Good old John.
Right.
He's living out in the desert where he can see them.
Right, and see them clearly.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, that's my opening salvo.
Well, I have an opening salvo, too, because it's a poem I used to teach a lot, but it's a poem that, thinking about it, being isolated in my home for the last 6 weeks or so, I thought really speaks to to the situation we're in. It's called Traveling Through the Dark by William Safford. And I think one of the things we all realize, if we didn't know it before, is that every human being is in some ways traveling through the dark. This is a poem by the narrator is a man who is driving through along a narrow mountain road and comes across a deer that has only recently been killed. It's William Safford is the poet. Traveling Through the Dark. Traveling through the dark, I found a deer dead on the edge of Wilson River Road. It's usually best to roll them into the canyon. That road is narrow. To swerve might make more dead. By glow of the taillight, I stumbled back of the car and stood by the heap, a doe, a recent killing. She had stiffened already, almost cold. I dragged her off. She was large in the belly. My fingers touching her side brought me the reason. Her side was warm. The fawn lay there waiting, alive, still, never to be born. Beside that mountain road, I hesitated. The car aimed ahead its lowered parking lights. Under the hood purred the steady engine. I stood in the glare of the warm exhaust turning red. Around our group, I could hear the wilderness listen. I thought hard for us all, my only swerving, then pushed her over the edge into the river. We're damned if we do and damned if we don't in this virus, right? I mean, we can't have both things we want.
You know, we think about, you can't help but think about all the people dying. And death is very much with us. But, you know, you can't let you can't be overwhelmed by that. I go back to Milton talking about his blindness. Think of Shakespeare being deaf, Beethoven being deaf, and then Milton being blind. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide. Doth God exact day labor, light denied, I fondly ask? But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies. God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. And that's what we're doing.
Right.
Standing and waiting. Your turn.
Okay, I've got a poem by Jane Kenyon. I have, in fact, several. I recently pulled her out. I haven't read her much since I taught her 20 years ago. But this is what I mean about the fact that even though we are restricted in what we can do, we can all go out to the backyard and notice small things that we should have noticed all along. We don't have to have in our lives large epiphanies. We can have small epiphanies, little moments when we suddenly notice something. And I think in the busyness of our normal lives, we tend to overlook this. This is a poem called Coming Home at Twilight in Late Summer. You've all been there, that is, coming home late at night, tired out from driving all day. It's been a long vacation, and you're ready for it to be over. And just as dark is approaching, you pull into your driveway. We turned into the drive, and gravel flew up from the tires, like sparks from a fire. So much to be done, the unpacking, the mail and papers, the grass needed mowing. We climbed stiffly out of the car. The shut-off engine ticked as it cooled. And then we noticed the pear tree, the limbs so heavy with fruit they nearly touched the ground. We went out to the meadow, our steps made black holes in the grass, and we each took a pear and ate and we're grateful.
Very nice. Where do you find these things?
A long time of teaching and just coming by accident, I just happen to really like Jane Kenyon a lot because her husband, Donald Hall, the poet, said that she's the poet of the luminous particular. Those small moments in our lives, washing dishes or coming home from a vacation, that suddenly, if you look, are miraculous and and full of wonder.
Here's one that one of those prophetic things and things you worry about from Yeats. The first part of it is familiar. The second part, maybe not so much. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. I think that expresses the worry that occupies a lot of people. And it's really very well put by Yeats. I don't think we'll ever be rid of those words, that particular poem.
No, I don't think so.
Well, back to you.
Okay, I'm on a little happier note. I want to read Mary Oliver. She's really good for the soul these
days. I was
going
to mention her. Oliver, you talk about small things and so on.
She died this past winter. But she's a favorite, I think, of many poets in the Quad Cities and many people generally. This is the poem that begins her collection of poems called Why I Wake Early. Hello, sun in my face. Hello, you who make the morning and spread it over the fields and into the faces of the tulips and the nodding morning glories and into the windows of even the miserable and crotchety. Best preacher that ever was, dear star, that just happens to be where you are in the universe to keep us from ever darkness, to ease us with warm touching, to hold us in the great hands of light. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Watch now how I start the day in happiness, in kindness.
There's a classic poem that looks at that in a more general way that I've always liked by Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went all morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breasts and, bright wings.
That's a great last right wings, isn't it?
This is the poem I spent a whole class on when I was teaching senior English at Alleman, because there's so much you can draw from this. It's a great poem.
Well, I have a favorite poem that is along the same lines that I used to teach a lot. I enjoy teaching it because it's so easy to talk about what's going on in poetry with this poem. Title is a phrase from St. Augustine, "Love calls us to the things of this world." And it's by Richard Wilbur, who deserves a lot more attention than he's gotten. He seems to have fallen by the wayside. It's about a man who is waking up in a tenement section of a city, tenement section being that he's on the third floor or so of a tenement house. And across the way, there's another tenement. And between, across the alley, there are pulleys and ropes where washerwomen are hanging out washing. And so he's awakened barely by the cry of the squeak of the pulleys and the flap of the laundry. And then as he wakes up in his half-dream world, he imagines these are angels. But then he wakes up and realizes, no, it's just laundry, right? Just blouses and sheets. And then he gets up and dresses and starts to, all of us live in these two worlds, don't we?
Yeah.
And as did Yeats and as does Mary Oliver. So let me, so this is the three-part poem. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice, as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone. And the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." It's that balance that's hard for all of us to keep.
That's true. I want to switch gears now. You know, we have argued about poetry and the canon. And by the way, we're going to be repeating the programs on the canon starting next week. We don't want to bring people into the studio while there is a lockdown. So for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be repeating three programs. Two from 3 months ago on the canon, and one from over a year ago on how to write. But any arguments about poetry, I stood up for Phyllis McGinley, who writes light verse, and people look down on that. But I like her explanation. First of all, it's profitable to write light verse because people read it. And second, it appeals to the intellect perhaps more than the emotion, because you admire the skill of how it's put together. I want to read two excerpts from her collection, Saints and Reformers, which illustrate this. First is The Thunderer. God's angry man, his crotchety scholar, was St. Jerome, the great name-caller, who cared not a dime for the laws of libel, and in his spare time translated the Bible. Quick to disparage all joys but learning, Jerome thought marriage better than burning, but didn't like women's painted cheeks, didn't like Romans, didn't like Greeks, hated pagans for their painted pagan ways, yet doted on Cicero all his days. A born reformer, cross and gifted, he scolded mankind sterner than Swift did, worked to save the world from the heathen, fled to a cave for peace to breathe in, promptly wherewith, for miles around, he filled the air with fury and sound. In a mighty prose for almighty ends, he thrust at his foes, quarreled with his friends, and served his master, though with complaint. He wasn't a plaster sort of saint, but he swelled men's minds with a Christian leaven. It takes all kinds to make a heaven. And then switching from saints to reformers, whenever Mr. Edwards spake in church about damnation, the very benches used to quake from awful agitation. Good men would pale and roll their eyes while sinners rent their garments to hear him so anatomize hell's orgiastic torments. The blood, the flames, the agonies in store for frail or flighty New Englanders who did not please a whimsical almighty. Times were considered out of tune when half a dozen nervous female parishioners did not swoon at every Sunday service. And if they had been taught aright, small children, carried bedwards, would shudder lest they meet that night the God of Mr. Edwards, Abraham's God, the wrathful one, intolerant of error, not God the Father or the Son, but God the Holy Terror. I love that. Really. And Phyllis McGinley, you know, she's, that does appeal to your to the intellect, that you admire the skill, the way it all goes together. She's capable of writing very moving things, too, I must say. But I greatly admire her, although she fell out of favor because she celebrated domesticity at the very time the feminist movement was rising, and they all dismissed her, all of them. Too bad, because as Auden said, she's a great poet.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen her in an anthology that we used at Augie to teach.
I had two copies of Times 3, a collection of her best works. I gave one away to our very first guest, and I can't find the other copy. It drives me crazy because I love Phyllis McGinley. She has little four-line things. The old pastor, God's mansion has been his such ages. No, let's see. Oh, I can't recall it now. I remember the old actor. Too lined for Hamlet on the whole, for Lear too grossly built, himself becomes his favorite role, played daily to the hilt. Your turn.
That reminds me of Robert Frost's little poem. What is it? Oh, Lord, forgive the little jokes I played on thee. And I'll forgive the great big one you played on me.
Yeah. Frost is very good. Okay, your turn.
Okay, I've got another Jane Kenyon poem called The Bat. And it's about the theme that essentially we've been falling into lately, between the mundane and the magical. The Bat. I was reading about rationalism. The kind of thing we do up north in early winter, where the sun leaves work for the day at 4:15. Maybe the world is intelligible to the rational mind, and maybe we light the lamps at dusk for nothing. Then I heard wings overhead. The cats and I chased the bat in circles, living room, kitchen, pantry, kitchen, living room. At every turn it evaded us, like the identity of the third person in the Trinity, the one who spoke through the prophets, the one who astounded Mary by suddenly coming near.
Very nice. Very nice. I have one by Art Mample, whom we know. It's called My Career as a Human. I have tons of poems by Art Mample, but I'll be darned if I know where I put them. But I found this one. Art Mample took a... I don't know if you'd call it abuse, but he had a hard time growing up as a little kid. But this poem, let me show you the form it's in, sort of like prose. But My Career as a Human. I recall flashes of its beginning, unfair shadows still marked in memory. The time Alvin stole the mouth organ I was blowing, cutting off the air and a possible career in music. Other times, too, playing horse with a rope around my waist, running for my brother in the tall grasses, calling out in a big voice, "Go, laddie, go!" Go as the wind moving the thunderheads, as a thoroughbred leading the race. Go as Trigger and Roy in hot pursuit of black cats riding dirty horses. Ridden, tired and resting, I had to eat the ripe and tall grass to prove I was genuine horse flesh. My sister sold me mud pies at her store under our porch in Maplewood, Minnesota, and I was informed that if I buy them, I must eat them in her presence. And I did. When we played cowboys in our back sandlot, I was always the bad dude who they tied up in the hot sun till Dad came home from working on a neighbor's car. Father once called me the poor lad, a recognition of continuous hits, lying in wait to ambush my carefree days, to dash any high hopes or bright endings. Survival is a strong instinct. Reversing it can wake up levity and sharpen the wit. To choose kindness over anger can disarm the accuser. It occurred to me then, it may even reverse the outcome of my career as a human. Way to go, Art. Got another one?
I've got one more Jane Kenyon poem. Well, I've got 10 or 15 more, but this is another one. It's called Coats. And it's a perfect example of what I've been trying to say this morning, and that is that in the enforced solitude of all, we have time to notice small things that we should have been noticing all along and overlooked and missed out. This is called Coats. I saw him leaving the hospital with a woman's coat over his arm. Clearly, she would not need it. The sunglasses he wore could not conceal his wet face, his bafflement. As if in mockery, the day was fair and the air mild for December. All the same, he had zipped his own coat and tied the hood under his chin, preparing for irremediable cold.
And I have another one. I have another one about stars. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. My favorite Walt Whitman poem.
That is that same dichotomy, right?
Yeah.
Between the looking at the world the way the poet does and the what's really neat about that poem, I've taught that a lot too, is the way, and when he's talking about the learned astronomer, his sentences get more and more choppy and cut off and lined up like the astronomer lines up. Yeah. And then as he talks about what the poet does, they get smoother and smoother and smoother until the last line is the smoothest.
Well, speaking of chopped off, I guess we are. That'll do it for this session. Next week begins our repeat programs, two on the canon, followed by one on how to write as if we knew. I'm Don Moot with Roll Tweet. See you after a while on Scribble.